This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have done things you are going to have a hard time trying to fathom as we listen to their stories. It really is incredible, the things we hear and the things we learn on this program. We want our veterans to know that we appreciate what they've done for us. We want to honor their service, the sacrifices they made. We want to hold on to their stories so the price that's been paid for our freedom is not forgotten. And along the way, like I said, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, sometimes inspired by these stories from men and women from our greatest generation. And we're going to meet one of those guys today. We're going to hear about a lady, too, the Lady Lex, the USS Lexington. Maybe you know the history of that ship in World War II. Let's get to know Gordon Scott of Kingsburg, California, almost 92 years old. And your birthday has a lot to do with the story we're going to hear in World War II. I know you signed up on your 18th birthday. So what, you figured you graduated from Kingsburg High School and the only thing to do was join the Navy? There's a lot of water around here, I guess, huh?
Well, I thought of getting into aviation some way, and somebody told me about might be able to get into aviation in the Navy, and I inquired about it, and the rest is a little history. I did get into it, but it took a little longer to get into it than I thought.
Why the interest in flying? Were you reading about Lindbergh or what?
A local fellow here by the name of Luther Linda that used to have an air strip just north of Kingsburg, on just off of Stroud Avenue here. He had been a pilot in World War II and had planes out of there, and I got to know Luther real well. It's all set residential now. The airstrip is gone and Luther's gone. You can get in aviation. What I was interested in is probably getting eventually into flight school, but when you get out in the fleet and you get involved in a deal there, it's a little harder to get into aviation. I was on a carrier and in the Air Department throughout my career in the USS Lexington. But eventually I got back to the United States and was stationed at Naval Air Station in Corpus Christi, Texas, where they train pilots. And by then, I could have probably went to flight school, but had got married and passed it up.
But a lot happened in between. You were in for exactly 6 years, enlisted on your 18th birthday, discharged on your 24th birthday. But when you went in on July of 1940, did you have any idea America was going to be at war in a year and a half?
No, I didn't. When I first got in the Navy, I went to San Diego Naval Training Station and was there in training program for 3 months. And for a while, I thought I might have been in the Army. We'd done so much drilling. But they do teach you a lot of things, and not only drilling and marching and various things like that, but they had various schools like firefighting school, and I didn't realize how important firefighting school was for the Navy. Our ship eventually burned up, so it was quite a deal there.
What was your first impression of the Lexington? When did you go aboard that ship?
When I got through after 3 months in Naval Training Station San Diego, was sent to Long Beach, and we got on a destroyer and sent to Long Beach and was stationed on the USS Arizona. I left from Long Beach and went to Bremerton, Washington Naval Shipyard there, and the Lexington was in there, and after about a month on the USS Arizona, I was transferred to the Lexington, which was very fortunate from what happened to the Arizona.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people are saying, whoa, I've heard of that ship. Maybe I visited what's left of that ship as it still sits there in Pearl Harbor with those teardrops of oil bubbling to the surface. I imagine that means you probably knew a fair amount of those more than 2,000 sailors that died that day, not all on the Arizona, but did you know a lot of those who are still on the Arizona?
Well, I didn't know that many. After all, I was only aboard Arizona for about a month, but then I went on the Lexington. I did get to know a few people, and I've never found out what's happened to them. But the Lexington, I got aboard the Lexington and was stationed in what they call V1 Division, which had the after flight deck deal on the carrier. We were there for about a month and left from there and went back to Long Beach, and from there we went from Long Beach to Pearl Harbor.
And this is all still before anything has happened war-wise. America is not at war. Were there any rumblings that you guys were preparing for something like that?
No, we had done nothing but training was in and out of Pearl Harbor and flight quarters and training both our crew and the pilots too. We didn't hear anything about war till the national emergency started. There, when we'd go to sea, even after before we were in the war, we'd go to sea and it was just blackout at night and the lights and everything. So they were looking for something, but we really didn't know about anything. But it was more of a training program.
And we've heard a lot over the years about December 7th and what Pearl Harbor was like that day from different vantage points. Maybe you can give us a sense of what it was like around there before all this happened. Was it almost like an adventure for you to be out in that part of the world?
At that time, you didn't realize it was quite a resort deal like it is today. And we were away from home, so it wasn't as luxurious as we thought it might be, but it is a great place. The Hawaiian Islands are really great, and the people are very nice.
And I mentioned that date, December 7th, and you might have been there December 7th, but the Lexington shipped out the day before?
Yes, we were anchored just on the left side of Ford Island, which is a Naval Air Station in Pearl Harbor. And we left out on our way to Midway with a load of Marine planes to reinforce Midway. When we heard about the war, or they bombed Pearl Harbor, we turned around and tried to intercept. We did launch the planes off and leave them at Midway, but we turned around and tried to intercept them, and we couldn't find them, and probably very lucky we didn't, because we didn't have a big fleet with us. The original Lexington had 5-inch guns, 4 batteries of 5-inch guns, and 4 turrets that was almost like a battleship. It had originally been built for a battle cruiser. Right after the war started, we went back into the naval shipyard there and took the turrets off and got rid of the 5-inch guns, and they put all in anti-aircraft guns, because that was what it's going to be all about, fighting planes.
And you mentioned when the war started, but I imagine that's a pretty significant memory for you, how you found out you're aboard the Lexington and you just left Pearl Harbor yesterday and now they're bombing Pearl Harbor. How did that news come to your ship?
Well, of course, it was transmitted by radio to the ship, and they announced it on the loudspeaker and sounded general quarters. From there, they had bringing up all the ammunition and everything for all the gun turrets and the 5-inch guns and whatever. We tried to find the Japanese fleet, but it was very fortunate we didn't, because they probably could have blown us out of the water. So we steamed around and never did find where they came from or anything. And we turned around after 3 or 4 days, came back into Pearl Harbor, and it was we just couldn't believe it. The USS Utah, which is an old battleship that had retired and they were just using it for training purposes, had taken our berth on Ford Island. And you don't hear anything about the USS Utah, but it's still underwater alongside Ford Island right now. They literally blew it up and had thought that we would be there. They knew every ship that was there. The only mistake I think the Japanese made, right above at the Pearl City there, up on the hill was Red Hill. All of the fuel for all of the ships and everything were in big tanks there. If they'd have bombed those, we would have had to come clear back to the mainland United States. They didn't touch them. That was a big mistake they made.
Yeah, and a big what if, and you've got a few of those. What if you had remained on the Arizona? You wouldn't be here. And as you said, the Utah, which along with the Arizona, the Oklahoma, was taken out that day, it was in your spot. So that's another what if you had still been there?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, couldn't believe it. The Utah is still underwater there. They never have done anything about it.
And I want to discuss a little more of that scene that you saw when you sailed back into Pearl, but you mentioned going to general quarters on your ship, the Lexington. What did that mean for you personally? What was your duty station at that point?
We were up on the flight deck, and of course, we didn't launch any planes. We were scouting around trying to find the Japanese fleet, too. And we had search planes up, landed them back aboard, but we just couldn't believe it.
And when you did roll back into Pearl, and you mentioned the Utah being in your spot, but most of us weren't there, and maybe we've seen some grainy film or we've seen some black and white photos, but you saw it in living color that day. What did you see, and what did it do to you?
We just couldn't believe it. It was almost sick. Oil on the water and the ships, they weren't burning then, but, I mean, sunk. The battleship, there's what we call Battleship Row on one side of the island, was the opposite side where the carriers used to anchor, which was very, very fortunate. The whole time I was in there, from when I first got to Hawaii and Pearl Harbor, I don't believe I ever seen that there wasn't a carrier in port. And it's really amazing that the Saratoga at that point was back in the mainland in the United States. And I keep referring to the United States because Hawaii wasn't in the United States at that time. It just was unbelievable to see the destruction. The ships underwater and everything. And I forget how long it took. We refueled, reprovisioned, and we left out of there. And we never came back. I don't know the exact number of days. I used to, but it's been a long time ago. But I would say 90 days at sea without touching port. And we never did find the Japanese.
Well, you guys would have a pretty impressive encounter with them in late February. But I want to get a taste for what it was like aboard the Lexington, because we've maybe seen the posters with the tattered flag and Remember Pearl Harbor, or we've seen, of course, the legendary song Remember Pearl Harbor. But is it too melodramatic to say that was a rallying cry aboard your ship? What was the impact on morale, on motivation, on what that did for you guys to have seen that devastation and to know that now your country is at war?
First of all, it was hard to believe. Even though we had been training for war, really, and all the time prior to December the 7th, we'd be in and out of Pearl Harbor. We'd alternate with ships. There was the Enterprise and the Yorktown and the Saratoga were always, Saratoga wasn't there as much. That was the sister ship of the Lexington. And the Yorktown and the Enterprise were then two sister ships too. And between the three main deals, the Enterprise and the Yorktown and the Lexington, there was always someone in port. And just like, it wasn't a coincidence that no ship or carriers were in there. All the battleships were. But it was just kind of hard for us to believe. And the devastation was just unbelievable.
How did that leave you guys feeling about the future or about the Japanese or about the task that you had at hand now?
We knew that's what we were there for. And when we were out, after we left out of Pearl Harbor, after we came back in and then left out and was gone for about approximately 90 days at sea, we were all over the Pacific trying to find the Japanese fleet or whatever, maybe trying to make them think we had more than we did, but I'm sure that they knew we didn't have more. And then on February the 20th, we were going to try to make a strike on the Japanese in Rabaul. And Rabaul is quite a bit above the Guadalcanal, east side of Guadalcanal, further up in there. And we were going in there and try to bomb them in Rabaul. On the 20th, they spotted us, or one of their planes spotted us. There was 9 Mitsubishi 97, which is called Bettys, that came out and attacked us. They got to the dropping point, and the captain of the ship had somebody with binoculars, and was supposed to let them know when they seen the bombs drop. And he swung the ship around, and it just thudded around the stern of the ship and missed the ship.
Where were you while that was going on? What were you supposed to be doing?
Well, at that point, we had launched our planes, and we were waiting for some of our planes to come back in. Like I said, we had charge of the resting gear in the after part of the ship. This is the barrier cables and cross-deck pennants that go across the ship that the planes catch with the hook of their deal and stop the planes from crashing. So we were just waiting for our planes to come back, and our planes then were chasing the first wave of 9. When they were chasing them, here come another wave of 9, and we had Lieutenant Butch O'Hara and another fellow that was in above the ship circling and just above what we call CAP. But he shot down, I think, eventually total 5 planes. The other fellow's guns jammed, and when they were chasing these planes away, that was a wave of 9, and he shot 5 of those down. And we don't know how many got back in the first flight either. But we turned around and got out of there because we were up, and it was way above the Guadalcanal at that time, which Rabaul was quite deep in Japanese territory at that time. So we turned around and hauled out of there and got clear of there.
I'm just trying to imagine what it's like to be you. So your job is, when these planes are going to land, to make sure that tail hook catches the cable and they don't go careening off the deck. But it's probably a pretty helpless feeling while you're waiting for those planes to come in and just watching this battle rage in the sky. I mean, could you guys see the bombers and see O'Hare and the fighters?
We could see them when they first came over and dropped the bombs. We could see them coming down. But when O'Hare and the other fellow, I can't remember his name, was actually chasing them, they were out of sight. So
So what did you guys do while that was going on? I mean, I'm trying to imagine what you could do. You have to be pretty concerned about your ship's future here.
We probably were a little scared, really. I mean, we were up in their territory quite a bit, and here twin-engine bombers coming out after us. And like I say, we turned around and hauled out of there. It's kind of a helpless feeling to when you are attacked, there's not much you can do. I mean, our duties there was in the after deck of the planes that would be landing and the resting gear. Oh, we had trained on the guns at different times and everything, but they had all those manned from the gunnery department and everything. I don't know what altitude that they dropped the bombs for, but with twin-engine bombers, there could have been quite a ways up.
And it's not like you can do anything about it. You can't take cover anywhere. You've got to stay there on the deck ready to do your job, right?
That's right. There's not much you can do. And it's really a kind of a helpless feeling.
You mentioned them chasing those bombers, and they're flying F-4Fs at the time?
F-4Fs. Actually, F-4Fs was like a bumblebee. They were very short wingspan, not much in length. They had so much torque that when they would take off down the deck, they would just move sideways. The change in aviation from the planes that we had then and what got later and then even throughout later in the war, too, were just unbelievable.
Yeah, the pace of the advancement was pretty extraordinary, but so were the heroics of some of the men who flew those planes, men like Butch O'Hare. And I want to ask you a little more about his legendary day when we come back. We're also going to discuss, of course, the last moments of the USS Lexington. Gordon Scott was there on May 8th, 1942, the Battle of the Coral Sea. And he'll take us back to that fateful day when Hometown Heroes continues right after this.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
21 years ago this year, a young Navy officer stood at the White House and was decorated by President Roosevelt with a Congressional Medal of Honor for heroism extending far beyond the line of duty. I remember as a young naval officer myself how the extraordinary feat of Butch O'Hare captured the imagination not only of our armed forces but also of the country. His extraordinary act in protecting his ship, shooting down, while he was alone, shooting down five of the enemy during difficult days in the Second War, gave this country hope and confidence, not only in the quality and caliber of our fighting men, but also in the certainty of victory. And therefore, 21 years later, I'm proud to come to Chicago, to this airport, to take part in this act, which commemorates his public service, his great naval service, and also reminds me of how much we owe to those who made this country of ours.
I'm sure you recognize that voice, President John F. Kennedy in 1963, rededicating Chicago's airport, which had been renamed in 1949 in honor of Butch O'Hare. Perhaps you've flown into that airport, but have you ever heard the story of the man that it's named for? We're getting a little taste of that today because the ship you heard JFK talk about was the USS Lexington. And our guest today, Gordon Scott, was on the deck of that carrier as O'Hare made history up above it in his F-4F Wildcat. That was February 20th, 1942. And when O'Hare and his wife Rita went to the White House to receive his Medal of Honor 2 months later, here's what the citation said: for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity in aerial combat at grave risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty. Having lost the assistance of his teammates, Lieutenant O'Hare interposed his fighter between his ship and an advancing enemy formation of 9 attacking twin-engine heavy bombers. Without hesitation, alone and unaided, he repeatedly attacked this enemy formation at close range in the face of intense combined machine gun and cannon fire. Despite this concentrated opposition, Lieutenant O'Hare, by his gallant and courageous action, his extremely skillful marksmanship in making the most of every shot of his limited amount of ammunition, shot down 5 enemy bombers and severely damaged a 6th before they reached the bomb release point. As a result of his gallant action, one of the most daring, if not the most daring, single action in the history of combat aviation, he undoubtedly saved his carrier from serious damage. That's the Medal of Honor citation for Navy Ace Butch O'Hare. You've heard of Ace in a Day. I guess he was ace in a matter of hours there. And Gordon Scott was on the Lexington when O'Hare took off. He was there when he landed and all the time in between. So, Gordon, Butch O'Hare, what he did, quite an impressive feat, huh?
It certainly was. When he came back aboard and landed and everything, it just unbelievable. And I'm sure he couldn't believe what he had done either.
Were you part of securing his plane when it landed?
Well, like I say, I was in V1 division, which was in the resting gear in the back. When the planes land there, they have a tail hook at the back of the plane. The resting gear cables are hydraulically controlled, and they raise up to about 10 inches. If they miss one of them, they go into barriers and crash. There's a landing signal officer in the back on the port side in the back that helps them come in and gives them the directions, whether too high or too low or whatever, and then he gives the deal to cut. Reciprocal engines before the jet engines, when a plane came in, they had to come in and fly in speed, and then when they tried to land, they actually had to cut power. And if they didn't make the deal and whatever, they'd crash. On a jet plane today, when they come in, they land and hit the throttle full speed, and if they miss, they can take off and go back around. But the carrier decks now are slanted instead of straight away like they used to be.
You mentioned O'Hare coming back, and it was unbelievable. Was there some celebration on the ship?
Yes, there was. I don't think he realized what he had done either. There was a lot of celebration because it was quite a feat, and it was early in the war, too.
He was the first Navy pilot to become an ace and then the first to win a Medal of Honor, and he won it for that day.
That's right, and he was then brought back to the United States and, I shouldn't say paraded around, but went around with the morale for the people back here, what had happened and everything, and selling more war bonds and so forth. But it was the same kind of a deal that they brought back the people that raised the flag at Iwo Jima, brought all those boys back home too.
And how did that play on the ship? I imagine some guys might say, hey, that guy just kind of saved our ship by shooting down 5 Japanese bombers. We need that guy. Keep him here.
Yeah, that's right. He came back later as a skipper of a fighter squadron.
Yes, he did. He was in charge of all the different planes flying off the carrier USS Enterprise and on a night fighter mission in an F-6F Hellcat on November 26, 1943. O'Hare was shot down. His body was never found. His plane was never found. Before the end of the war, the Navy had named a destroyer for him, and Butch O'Hare remains one of the more well-known of the more than 405,000 Americans who died while serving in World War II. And I bring that up with you, Gordon, because you and all the other veterans I interview always tell me that the real heroes of World War II are those that never came home. Butch O'Hare, of course, one of those. And what impression did he make on you during your time together on the Lexington?
I didn't have a lot to do with him, but he was a very humble person. I mean, it wasn't a guy that, you know, blowing that he had done this and everything. It was an unbelievable feat.
Yes, sir, without question. You know, I have some links to more information on Butch O'Hare if you visit hometownheroesradio.com. But let's get back to your story, Gordon. What was next for you and the Lady Lex?
Well, from there, we got back in and back to Pearl Harbor. And I think it was somewhere about 113 days or something like that that we'd been at sea. And we came back in and refueled and went back to sea.
I see here that in March, you and the Yorktown, the Lexington and the Yorktown, sent some planes off the north coast of New Guinea at some Japanese bases.
We didn't realize it at the time, but in March, when we attacked at Solomalu and Leia in New Guinea, that was on the west side of New Guinea, and we went around to the eastern side, and there was a pass in the mountains there that was the planes that we had then, the service ceiling, which you could actually wouldn't go above that, or would be pretty hard to go above it, could go through this pass, and they went through and bombed the ships, and they sank several of their ships and probably stopped the. In fact, Australia never forgot it. I mean, they thought that would have been a stepping stone of invading Australia. At one of the reunions we had in the Lex, one of the last ones, they even sent a representative from Australia thanking us. I mean, it was quite unbelievable. But that was stopping the Japanese from really getting into Australia. They had to fly through this pass in New Guinea and then bomb them and then get back before the cloud formations closed the pass off. So it was pretty well timed.
And you tell that story, and it makes me wonder, did you guys have a sense of that at the time? I mean, would pilots come back, tell you what they did? Would you understand the significance of it, or do you only understand that with the lens of history now?
Well, we didn't, really didn't, other than we sank a lot of ships and probably crippled a lot of others. but we didn't understand the deal and the implications of the Australians figure it saved them from being invaded later.
Well, and a couple months later, you guys would be looking for someone to save you. What do you remember about May 7th, 1942, and the day that followed?
Some of our scout planes sighted a Japanese fleet in carriers and cruisers, battleships, and everything. We sent planes and attacked them and sank one carrier and damaged another one. And then the next day, our planes were going back and attack them again. They had spotted us in the meantime. In mid-flight, here was a fleet from the care of their carriers coming back to attack us. And they passed each other going, we're going to attack them and they're coming to attack us. Well, they got to us about 11 o'clock in the morning. They came in with dive bombers and torpedo planes. We took one torpedo hit on the port side and took two bomb hits, one in the superstructure on the starboard side and another bomb hit on one of the gun stations on the port side. There was a lot of damage, but our planes came back, and we had never had over an 8-degree list on the ship, and we landed, got back into the wind to land our planes that were coming back from attacking them, and landed our planes back, didn't land all of them, but we landed the ones that were there. Then they were refueling our planes to go back for another attack, and apparently it had ruptured some gasoline lines internally in the ship and was spewing gas out. That's very high octane gas, and it started burning up inside. And indirectly, the Japanese didn't sink us from their bomb hits or torpedo hits, but our ship burned up. That was at 11 something in the morning, and we didn't abandon ship till 5:18 that night.
And you're describing that, and I'm thinking, what did that look like? What did that feel like? And as you described, you still had to land your plane, so you're still there at your duty station, and your ship is damaged and on fire. Let's start here, maybe. Can you help us understand what that felt like when the torpedo and those bombs hit the Lexington?
I was about what we call the barrier cables that stop the planes if they're going to crash. Needless to say, people say they're not scared. I think they're damn liars. But was back right by the superstructure. And when we were attacked, pretty good jolt when you get a torpedo hit and a bomb hit, or one of the bomb hits in the superstructure right above us where we were. And I don't know, it's quite a feeling. It's hard to explain, really. But then the ship, the rest of our planes that were still in the air, the Yorktown took, I don't know how many it was, but landed the rest of our planes on the Yorktown. We would send crews down fighting the fire internally. In the Navy, from where the ship was first built, I think they painted every week for an inspection. And I don't know how thick the paint was on the metal between and all the compartments, but they had doors that you could what call them, dog them down with latches on them and close them like locking a door in a house. It would get so hot on one side, it would start paint burning on the other side. So literally, that just went from compartment to compartment and dogging them down, burning, crews going down. Then people more and more began coming up on the flight deck. We had a little over probably 2,000 people aboard the ship. I don't know if there wasn't 2,000 up there because there were still people going down and fighting the deal. And just waiting. I mean, a period of waiting, that was from 11 to 5 o'clock that night, just laying there, just ship burning up internally. People would get a little scared, and they'd take life rafts, rubber life rafts that were in the planes, and inflate them, throw them over the side. And there's quite a bit of current in the ocean. And these life rafts would just float away. One of the deals that I think it was, if I remember right, it was probably 5:18 that night when they told us to abandon ship. I'll never forget it. There was a destroyer that came alongside, and I went down. I was in the water and got picked up by the destroyer. I looked up, and here was a guy that was one of the squadron. We called him Porky Pref. He was in the torpedo squadron. Had inflated a big three-man or five-man life raft, and he tied a line to his wrist and another one to the raft and had some guys throw it over the side. Well, I was down on the destroyer, just got picked up, and I looked up, and here he come, ass over tea kettle, coming down. He forgot how far it was to the water, and that the raft got down to the water before he did. And I never seen the guy again for several years.
He survived that awkward tumble, huh? So you weren't in the water all that long? You got picked up quickly?
Got picked up and was later transferred to a cruiser, the USS Portland, transferred to a cruiser. And we were black from smoke and kind of sick and scared and everything else. And it was then starting to get dark, and we just laid down in one of the compartments of the ship. And cruisers have a couple seaplanes that they send up in scouting for the cruisers. That morning they shot one off, and we thought, my God, here we go again, someone's bombing the ship. But they had just shot one of the cruiser planes off.
And when you say that, maybe some people don't get it, because you're on a carrier, and those takeoffs are a little different. But on those cruisers, they actually literally shot them off. They used a gun to shoot them off.
One of the stories that came earlier on a trip going up to Rabaul, when we were going up there, the cruisers, it was USS Chicago that was with us. The Chicago had the two seaplanes up in the air scouting around, and they run into a rain squall. The rain was get so hard in the South Pacific, you can't believe it. They finally told the planes to land in the water. And we went on up from there. That was the day before we went up in the 18 Mitsubishi 97s attacked us. And we turned around and came back. And when we were coming back, they spotted this plane still floating in the water and taxied up under the deal of the Chicago and hoisted it back aboard. Somebody was looking after these guys.
I guess so. That's pretty remarkable. So the Lexington went down there in May of 1942. And obviously you survived and a lot were able to get off. You talked about the abandoned ship. When did you realize how many fellow sailors you lost that day?
We ended up in the Tonga Islands. We were in Tonga Tabu in the Tonga group. Tonga is several different islands. When we were there, well, there was a hospital ship there. A lot of our people were injured, went there, and several of them even died afterwards on the hospital ship. And a lot of people had to stay there. The rest of us were put on a transport that was in Tonga. We stopped back at Pearl Harbor and picked up some Marines that had been going back to the U.S. We came back to San Diego. We pulled in what they called a destroyer base. It's in the south from downtown San Diego, way back in the destroyer base. And when we pulled in there, there was a fellow there. He was a Commodore, which is very unusual in the Navy. Everybody called him Captain Mac, but he was one of the few people that was ever a Commodore. We got there, and they had it all set up in the barracks, clean bunks, mattresses, toilet articles. And if I remember right, it was $50 there, too, for everyone. That was in late afternoon, and they announced that anybody that had families in San Diego could go ashore that night. Well, I had a brother that was a foreman in one of the aircraft plants in San Diego, so I got to go ashore, and went down to the aircraft plant there, and he worked on a late night shift. Went up to the security there and told him who I was, and I was dungarees and no uniform, and the guy kind of looked at me suspiciously, and he radioed in or called in on the phone and got a hold of my brother, and he came out, and he couldn't believe. He says, "Did you desert the Navy?" We weren't supposed to tell anybody, but I had to tell him what happened, and we got back, and later they issued us clothing and everything the next day and got us all straightened out. Got to come back home to Kingsburg and hadn't said anything. I was walking down the streets here in Kingsburg when it came back and out in the news, and there was a fellow here from the Kingsburg Recorder newspaper that hunted me down and wanted to know what happened.
Your ship's been sunk. Your brother doesn't know about it. Nobody knows about it. But here all of a sudden you are, and they're wondering why. That had to be a pretty surreal kind of stretch of time there.
Yeah, it was. It was quite a deal. But I was fortunate. I got to come back to Kingsburg for a short time. Went back to San Diego after about 3 or 4 weeks. There's six of us. They divided us up in different sections. At first they tried to see if we couldn't get another carrier that was being built or about ready to get out of building and rename it the Lexington and put the whole crew on it, but they couldn't do that. So they divided our V1 division, which was the resting gear on the carrier, and they sent six of us to the Naval Air Station and shipyards in Philadelphia. And they were just starting a training school there. They were building so many Jeep carriers and other carriers at that time, they didn't have people trained really to man the deals. So they were setting up a deal, and they used the six of us for a while there in the training program to set it up. And then after about possibly a month, we were transferred to Norfolk, Virginia, to the naval base there. Went aboard another carrier, the USS Sewanee. Well, the Sewanee had been a carrier that had been a tanker or an oiler prior to that, and they were building what they called Jeep carriers and smaller carriers. But the Sewanee, There was four of them, the Suwannee, the Shenango, the Santee. Anyway, they had converted four of those and put flight decks on them, and the six of us went aboard the Suwannee. And after a short time, we went out to sea, had a group of new pilots qualify them. Some of them hadn't been landing on carriers. That was an experience, too, because there was a lot of accidents. And then after maybe a week or two, we got left out of there and went to Bermuda. Then we done the same thing. We came out of Bermuda and trained more pilots, landing more. We had a catapult on this carrier, launching planes and landing them back and training everybody on the ship. And might say that basically, by and large, the biggest percentage of the personnel on the ship had never been to sea before. So it was quite an experience to come aboard. And in our division, there was only six of us in our division. I don't know how many we had. We had one experience to show the lack of training. They had a plane hooked up on a catapult, and we were going to sea, and it sounded flight quarters. And this plane, normally you would never hook a plane up on the catapult. You put what they call a bridle up on the plane and attach it to the catapult. And this was all hooked up there, and I was there talking to one of the guys that was with us, leaning against the plane, and turned and went to the bridge just to get adjacent to us. And I heard a click, and I turned around, and here this plane had been fired off of the catapult and mowing people down, going down the deal. No one in the plane, and the plane wasn't turning up, and it was terrible. This friend of mine that had been there, the plane just run right over him. He'd hurt his back real bad, and he was in the hospital for a long time and killed quite a few people and maimed a lot of people. And it was a terrible accident. And they even held a court-martial on the chief that was down in the catapult room, why he fired it. But first they had sounded flight or general quarters, then they had sounded flight quarters and set condition of readiness. He didn't know. And then the guy in the deal up above was punching the deal. There's lights that come on down below to tell him when to fire. And this guy was testing it, and he pushed the wrong button, and it showed it to fire down the catapult room and fired this thing off with no one in it. That was terrible.
Again, I'm struck by something you said there. You said you had just walked away right before. If you had still been standing where you were, what would have happened to you?
That's right. I mean, I've been very lucky and still am.
And I know we're going to hear some more examples of why you can say that. Gordon Scott of Kingsburg, California is our guest, and we'll get the rest of his World War II story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 91-year-old Navy veteran Gordon Scott of Kingsburg, California. We've heard about his close calls aboard the USS Lexington, and 6 months after the sinking of the Lexington and the Battle of the Coral Sea, Gordon was on the USS Suwannee for the invasion of North Africa. What do you remember about that?
There's a captain of the ship. It was Captain J.J. Jocko Clark. He was, I think, one of the first part Indians to graduate from the Naval Academy and went to flight school, and he was a captain. He turned around, and we went back into port, and then we just took off and headed. Well, we didn't know where we were going. We was heading east, and then we finally found out we were going to North Africa, Casablanca, to start another invasion. Then it was the largest fleet I ever seen when we got there and started mobilizing and all the ships collecting together. I've never seen so many ships in my life. There was transports with crews. There was some destroyers that had been old destroyers, what we call four stackers, that had been converted, loaded with Marines to take them in close and land them. And ships of every caliber. I mean, from battleships to carriers to cruisers to destroyers and transports loaded with men. And I just couldn't believe it. I mean, it was a number of ships. The only trouble we had in North Africa wasn't from aircraft or anything, but submarines. The Germans had a lot of submarines, and there was a lot of fishing boats that were still out in the water, and they even threatened some of them to blow them out or get out of there because they were radioing, I think, some of these submarines, and they sank several submarines when they were there, but none of the ships were hit, but were never attacked by any aircraft or anything. But an invasion there was a French port. In the Vichy French there, they had Jean Bart, I think was a battleship that the French had, was in there. And we sent planes in and were bombing those, but they couldn't bomb any of the ships in there. They didn't want to touch any of the French ships. So it was quite a diplomatic deal. I mean, a diplomatic war. But anyway, that was probably the first invasion they started from Casablanca into Italy. And
so what happened to you the rest of the war? Because we're only about halfway through your 6 years in the Navy.
Left there, came back to Norfolk, Virginia. I didn't realize it till I was there a few weeks ago on the honor flight in Washington. Norfolk isn't too far from there. But anyway, we got back to Norfolk, and after refueling and reprovisioning and getting planes and stuff back aboard, we took off, and we didn't know again where we were going. And we finally got out, and we went through the Panama Canal. And we went through the Panama Canal at Christmas. Got through the Panama Canal and back out to the Pacific. We headed for the South Pacific, and we landed at Niumea, New Caledonia. And we were there. That's another French possession in the South Pacific. The French had a lot of possessions in the South Pacific. They abandoned a lot of them. But Niumea in New Caledonia was still a lot of French there. We were there for a short time, and the captain there wanted to get some flight time in. It was a big bay that we'd anchored in there, and the captain wanted to get some flight time in. I was in the air department there. I don't know how he asked me, but he asked me if I wanted to go up with him in one of the seaplanes that we had. He had a hard time getting it off of the water. He had to bounce it a little because there wasn't too much wind, and he finally got it up and flying out around their New Caledonia there in Niumea. He got up there and he radioed back and says, "It's all yours," laid back like that. And I flew the thing around for a while, and I kept the darn island in sight, because I'd get lost if I'd got out in the ocean. But we came back in and landed and hoisted the plane back. I think it was what we called a seaplane called a J2F that was a combination of a seaplane, and it also had wheels that could let down and land on regular runways too. Yeah, it was a J2F. We landed and brought that back aboard. We kept that down in the hangar deck, and they used it just for utility purposes and fly back and forth in some of the islands there.
Let me ask you real quick, because I was watching your facial expressions as you told that story, and you shared early on that you got into the Navy because you wanted to fly, and you had that dream of being a pilot. And now, thanks to his invitation there and his letting off the controls, you had that chance to fly that plane during World War II. What kind of excitement was that for you?
Like I said, I kept the island pretty much in sight. It wasn't probably just a straight line flight. I probably had it up and down and in and out a little, but was able to straighten it out after a while, and he slept a while and finally came back when we landed back.
Is it an exaggeration for me to say it was a bit of a dream come true for you?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I never thought of it, but it was quite a deal at that time. Later, I talked to the people in the air department and everything, and we had a commander that was in charge of the air department. I was interviewed by him and took an examination and was approved of an examination, but it was, I think I said earlier, it was pretty hard to get back to go to flight school when you were out in the fleet at that time. I only knew of one person that ever done it and got back. Well, it was either Pensacola, Florida, or Corpus Christi, Texas, where they trained them. But anyway, I'd passed all everything, the physicals and the exams and everything, but never did get to go.
Well, and at the end of the war, of course, you chose to come back here and have a family instead of pursue that, huh?
Well, was on the USS Suwannee, and from New Caledonia, we went to the New Hebrides Islands, which is further up towards Guadalcanal. All the time we would have planes in the air and landing planes or shooting planes off all the time whenever we were at sea. There was an island called Afati that was in the upper part of the New Hebrides Islands, and there was a big inlet back there. Ships could go back in. It was a deep water harbor, and go back in, way back in there. And they were building a landing strip. It was below Guadalcanal, and building a landing strip in there. And they had the Seabees in there building this. So we anchored there. We flew in and out of there and sending. That's when they had attacked it earlier from Guadalcanal and was fighting Guadalcanal. And we ship sending planes up from there up to Guadalcanal and back and forth when we would go out to sea. Landing strip that the Seabees were building still wasn't ready for landing planes on the beach. But we were in and out of there for a long time, and we'd go back to New Caledonia and then back up to the New Hebrides Islands and other islands. There's another island there called Ronell, Russell Islands. The South Pacific is full of islands. The New Hebrides Islands, it had been a French deal too, and back in there one time we'd went ashore there where they're building this airstrip and wandered back in, and they'd abandoned it years before. and it just, the jungle had grown over it. And here was, I don't know if it was lime trees or lemon trees back in the jungles, but the Japanese or the Frenchmen had left too, so we were just using it as a base for the ships in and out. It was terrible hot. I kept trying to get transferred and figured I had a better chance if I could get off of there to get maybe go to flight school or something. Finally, I got a deal that if I could get off of the ship was going to get underway the next day. They had a list, they're going to transfer some people off. And in the meantime, I had advanced my rank and I was the chief petty officer at the time. And they told me if I could get off before the ship got underway the next day with the party to go to this transport, I got transferred back off and sent back, got back to San Francisco, got 30 days leave, and got married. Yeah, was shipped to Corpus Christi, Texas, and I was stationed at the Naval Air Station in Corpus Christi, Texas, where they trained a lot of planes, but in the meantime, I'd got married and wasn't too interested in going to flight school then. Was in Corpus Christi, Texas, and I got stationed in what they call an O&R or A&R, it was assembly and repair. They'd bring a plane in one end of the building and take the engine out and disassemble the engine. They had engine department disassemble, and then the deal and goes in and rebuild the whole engine. Got a new engine, put it out the front door, and the plane going through and rebuilding the plane. So you're putting new products. It was actually a factory. We had both civilian, civil service personnel working there and naval personnel. And it was kind of a tough deal because a lot of the people that had been as civilians there that got drafted, and then when they looked at their MO or whatever they deal, they found out they were there and they put them back in there with a lot less pay. But anyway, I was there late 44. I got back to the States and went there, and then in 46, I got my discharge papers and came back.
So were you in Corpus Christi then when the war ended?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was in Corpus Christi till July of 1946.
What was that like there when that news hit where you were that this is over? You were in at the beginning of it back in December of 41, and now it's finally come to an end, and you're on the right side, the side that won.
Well, it was quite an experience, and exhilaration was glad it was over for the poor people that didn't make it home. But Corpus, there was another friend of mine that was in my same class in high school here after the war started. He went it the right way, went to college and then went in the Naval Reserve and got into flight school. And here he was in Corpus in the PBM squadron, seaplanes.
Small world. Would you say you were kind of relieved? Did you feel like you could get on with your life now that this was over?
I had an opportunity originally. I thought at the one time I would stay in the Navy. And then I had an opportunity to, my father-in-law was in business here, and he offered his son and me. His son was a naval pilot that went in after again with college, and his other brother was a Marine pilot, both of them killed, by the way. Anyway, was offered an opportunity to go in business here, and we opened up an auto parts store here in Kingsburg, and I was here 43 years and built it from scratch. My other brother-in-law that went in with me, he went back into service and was killed during the Korean War. Or the Vietnamese War, rather. I was very fortunate here. I had a good business, and eventually I turned it over to my son-in-law and my daughter, and I retired in Pebble Beach, California.
Played a lot of golf, a couple holes in one, I know you remember. And speaking of remember, I'm just listening to this, and you talk about your brothers-in-law who were killed in the war. And, of course, there were those lost on the Lexington. And you had the opportunity to go there to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight to see the World War II Memorial and to look at that wall of gold stars representing all 405,000 killed in World War II. What was that experience like for you? Did you think about those guys I just mentioned?
Paul, I sure did. I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is. And to go back there, I'd been to Washington, D.C. with my family one time, but never like this. And to see the wall and the names of the deal, and it's just unbelievable. And I just can't say enough for what you've done on the Honor Flight and Al Perry. And it wasn't an easy trip for us. Al Perry and his crew there, and the chaperones that were there were just tremendous. And there was a lot of people in wheelchairs. We had a lot of rain and everything. And yet they rolled with the punches, and it was just unbelievable. And then to come back with the people in Fresno, with the people from Lemoore Naval Air Station there standing in their dresser whites, saluting there as you came through the deal. It was just, I thought the whole Navy was there. And I tell you, it's one of the greatest things that I have ever seen. And if I can ever do it, and I've talked to Al, if I can ever help in any way, I think I told you earlier about letters that they sent, they had mail call.
And did you know that was coming when you were on the plane back?
No, I didn't. That was, it just was unbelievable. And I was clear in the back of the plane when I got that packet and opened it. And I really didn't read all of them. But then when I got home and got to reading them, here was letters from little kids in school and people. There was even a father from Modesto that wrote there about his children and what a wonderful deal that we were doing. But there was two kids here from the Herndon Barstow School in the sixth grade that put their name and address down in the class they were in and asked if I would write them and let them know what we'd done and everything. I was so impressed, I went by and seen them. And they brought them into the main office. And I was just thrilled to see these two young children. And there's one other one there that wasn't there that day that I'm going to go by after school starts and see him. But it was wonderful. Both you and Al and your crew have to be complimented for what you've done on this.
Well, we've got a long way to go to do anything close to what you and your fellow World War II veterans did for us. And I guess, and if there's anything else you want to mention, feel free. But I want to say thank you for serving our country and also for telling us about it. I know it's not always easy to talk about it. When you think about your children, your grandchildren, you're a great grandfather. There are a few generations of your family that wouldn't be here if some of those what ifs had gone the other way in your story. What do you want us to know and think about when we hear your story and we think about World War II?
I think World War II, the people that were in World War II, came home to people here that appreciated what we'd done and everything, and I think it's a real shame that they didn't do that in the other so-called wars that we had from the Vietnam and the Korean War. It's just totally amazing. But to see the people now, and even back on this trip back to Washington, when we landed in Baltimore, here were people greeting us there. I mean, it just, I don't know how this word has got around, but it's like a new deal, what's happening. Resurrection of thanking the people that were in the service.
Does it make you feel like you did something that mattered?
It certainly does. It's just hard to believe that the people now, and even in Baltimore, my God, they go through there in lines and people come up to you, see with your jacket or your hat, come up and the people in Washington, D.C., same deal. I don't know how many were in Fresno when we came home, and we were 2.5 hours late, which wasn't anyone's fault. I mean, it just happened. And to see this, the bagpipes and the people lined up, and going through this line and all these sailors there standing there, and I got down to the end, I couldn't believe it. Here, my whole family was there, from my grandsons, other people that I knew and everything, and they had waited 2.5, 3 hours, too. I just couldn't believe it. Somebody told me that that was the biggest crowd the parking lot has ever had in Fresno.
I don't know if this is an easy one to answer or not, but I've just heard you tell your story, and from, you know, being on the Arizona for a brief while and getting off before it met its fate to leaving that berth near Ford Island that the Utah inherited and sank, to surviving the sinking of your own ship and all those close calls. How do you account for that? How do you figure out why you and why you're still here and enjoying life in great shape at 92 almost?
Well, I think the good Lord looked after me. I tell you, there was a lot of times that I prayed out there when I was at sea. I don't know why I was picked to survive. And I just can't believe it. I mean, because there have been so many. There's other close calls that happened aboard ship a lot of times. I mean, a plane crash, and almost, I had one deal that a plane crashed and I crawled under the turret of this big gun, and about that far this plane crashed right into this thing. And so there's just so many things. A friend of mine, I'm standing one, we were having night carrier landings one time, and I'm standing talking to him, and was off of Honolulu out of Pearl Harbor. Prior to the war, we're training program, or people night flying and night carrier landings, and a plane comes in and busted one of the, what we call the cross-deck pennants that stops the planes, and it whipped around. I'd just been talking to him, and I turned around, and I hadn't got 10 yards away from him, and this plane crashed or busted this barrier cable or cross-deck pennant and hit him and took his leg off, we had a little net off the side of the ship like this, and it was dark, and they just heard somebody moaning and found him here in the net. But he was fortunate, he lost a leg. But I mean, there's just so many things that crashes. Another time a plane chased me in the flight deck that was coming in for a landing. I was up on the flight deck, and I just bailed out over the side into where the gun turrets were down there, knocked a guy flat down there, and I just head first. And this plane here, one wing was in the deck, flight deck, and the other one on top of one of the guns down there. Just so many things that happened. Like I say, the good Lord had to be looking out for me.
Well, I'm certainly not going to argue with you there, and I don't think anyone who's been listening for the past hour would do that either. That is Gordon Scott of Kingsburg, California. You'll find some photos of Gordon then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And, you know, there are a few more stories of Gordon's that I couldn't quite fit within the time constraints of the show. So you can find the entire interview, if you like, at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time for now. I hope you'll join us again next time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. And I don't want to drag on too long here, but just a couple more things that came to mind. One is you talk about that plane coming in and you bailing out of the way so it wouldn't kill you. And I'm thinking about the guy who's in that plane. And you wanted to be a pilot. You were around so many guys who were. Did you have an impression of what it took to be a naval pilot at that stage when things were so primitive and so hazardous? What kind of person it took?
The planes they were flying to start with and the planes that they ended up with is just tremendous in aviation. Yes, I still wanted to, even late in the war, still wanted to go, but I tell you, there's a lot of people that didn't come back in the planes. We had a lot of crashes at TBFs, especially. It's a three-man plane, pilot, radioman, and the turret deal. I used to fly off of it several times in the torpedo squadron in the turret deal, and one time we were out and all of a sudden the pilot radioed back, might have to bail out, and he says, get out of the turret and get the parachute, your parachute on. And I says, well, the radioman was on the radio and asked what happened. He says, we're losing oil. What he had done was practicing, going to make glide bomb runs, torpedo runs, come down like this where you come in low in the water. And he came in a little too sharp and came down almost in a dive bomb run. And the guy that had serviced the plane had forgot to put the oil cap on and was spewing oil all over and thought it was losing oil, going to have to go in. Well, you just can't land a plane back aboard ship, just boom. The whole fleet has to, if one ship turns, you might hit another ship. So they have to get radio communication or signals to get the whole fleet turned around to get into the wind to land this plane. Well, to get it turned around so we could land without bailing out, we finally got back around. And so there are just quite a few different deals that happened.
Yeah, you didn't really tell me about that. How often did you get up in those TBFs?
Well, I got flight pay, which was 30% of your base pay quite often. So whenever I got flight pay, I had to go up and the deal.
I'm sure there's tons that we haven't heard, but I sure do appreciate what we have. And I guess my final question is, and maybe it's, again, not an easy one to answer, but you just had that honor flight with, you know, 70 other guys of your generation. And I know that you have scores of friends who served in World War II, lived through that time in our history. And so many of us today didn't. And all we know of it is what we hear from guys like you. So do you think there's something that we as Americans today can learn from what America was like 70 years ago and what produced that victory in World War II?
Paul, I've thought a lot about it, and I don't believe that our country could ever mobilize what they did in World War II. I realize the circumstances were different. We were attacked. But there's just, when you stop and think of the mobilization that they had from building ships, there's so many, many stories that are just unbelievable. I mean, and shipbuilding alone was just fantastic. And advancement in the aviation and the aircraft. I don't even when we go in these wars now, it isn't the people are not behind them. They shouldn't take it on or take it out of the people that's in the service. It's not their fault. And they're coming home. A lot of these people, it's just, we had it easy.
Well, it sounds like, as you paint that picture, the difference is in how united the country was back then.
Unbelievable. Just look at the women and went into the overall and relieved men and worked in factories. And there was, what was it? We had 5 women that were in the service that went on this honor flight. And there's one, June, here, that lives in Kingsburg here. And she was in the Marines. And so women came in and took office jobs and different deals even in the service. The WACS had a deal in San Francisco. They took over the Marine Memorial Club on Sutter and Mason Street in San Francisco. They boarded, had that for a WACS deal during World War II, and then the Marines took it over and made it into a hotel, and it's still there today. Oh, it's great.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think I ought to know?
Well, Paul, all I can say, I got to thank you and for what you do, and it's a tremendous deal. There's just, I've dug up stuff since you've talked to me about it. I've never really talked to my family about this, and they know a few things, but my son wrote a letter in this mail call deal that came back that had tears in my eyes. I mean, I didn't realize that he knew as much of what happened when I was in the service, because I've really never talked to him much about it. Since then, I've dug out a lot of stuff that you can see here that I'm going to give them. Let them see it.